Welcome back for a new season of In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. I own Fausto and Lalu restaurants here in Brooklyn, New York. On today's episode of In the Drink, we have a really special guest, Roland Velich of Moritz Winery. In my opinion, Roland makes the greatest examples of the Blaufränkisch grape. Roland's passion for Blaufränkisch really comes through in this interview, and it was fascinating to me to find out that Blaufränkisch at one time was considered one of the greatest wines in the world and then lost its way, really only to be revived by Roland himself and a few other enterprising winemakers about 20 years ago. Roland's dedication to organic and natural winemaking while still making wines that are still beautiful, pretty, and precise is one of the things that really draws me to this winemaker. I hope you enjoy the interview. Why don't you tell me how you chose the name Moritz?
Well, first of all, I just saw this name. This is the Hungarian name of some nobility which lived in this place where I started to work, with this old Hungarian writing. And then I liked the way it looked like. Moritz is short with the open C at the end. And then we knew when we designed the labels, we knew exactly that everybody will ask us, why Moritz? So we hired a writer who wrote the story about four pages, which was 100% fake. Why Moritz is called Moritz. So we considered this as very funny, but then in the end, it was too long. But with the development of the whole project, I realized that this is something that Moritz, in the matter of fact, it's a metaphor for our region, because on the first glimpse, it looks Slavic. Everybody struggles how to pronounce it correctly. In the meantime, I say, you can pronounce it whatever you like. You can say Moritz, you can say Moritz, you can say Moritz, doesn't matter. Because it's a metaphor for the people living. We are at the end of the German-speaking world, surrounded by the Slavic word with this Hungarian part in the middle between. So, and that's great. We are living in an area where two major European landscapes are meeting, the Alps and the Pannonian Plains and the Carpathic Mountains. So it's a mixture of soil and climate and people. So if you like, Moritz is a metaphor for the place where we are.
And so your grandfather moved to the Burgenland from...
He moved to Vienna, and he lived in Vienna, and his my grandfather moved then, he was a teacher. He moved to Burgenland from Vienna because he, you know, some place was offered to him. And he found a place in Apetlon, which is on the eastern, southeastern shores of the Neusiedler Sea. And there he married a girl from a farmer's girl. And so the family stayed there. My parents, both of them, inherited some land, some vineyards, which they worked as their hobby. And we have to work there as well in the vineyards when we were 15, 16. And I hated it. You know, when all my colleagues ran out of the school with 15, said, now weekend, Saturday, Sunday. And we knew in the warm season, we were obliged to go to the vineyards. This was not fun. Not at all.
What drew you back in to do it?
Well, probably because I grew up with that. So my father loved to do wine, and wine was a topic in the family. Food was a topic. My mother is a very good cook. She lived a certain period of time in Paris, and she's cooking really good. So the whole family is committed with wine and cooking.
So for your father, it wasn't just a chore. He actually was interested in wine.
He was interested, So I grew up with that. So in a way, I inherited atmospherically this setting, you know, I think it was the smell maybe, you know, in autumn when the first bubbles came up through the must and brought the smell of fermenting must to the living room upstairs where I was lying probably in the cradle as a baby.
Was he bottling wine at that time?
Yeah, he started to bottle wines. I mean, we had some old bottlings, 64, 65, 69. He made his first DBA because this is a region where a lot of DBAs, Trockenbärenauslesen, sweet wine were produced. So we had a lot of these old, 69 was a great vintage Trockenbärenauslesen, which was really interesting. They still are quite good. You know, Ilmitz is the neighboring town of Apetlon. So Ilmitz is the place where Alois Gracher started to work then. And And then when I, you know, my brother is younger than me, and when we started the whole thing, I thought we have to do something now, because if we don't start it now, it will be too late. And then we did the first experiments in the late 80s, bought some barrels, did the first barrel fermented Chardonnay, because I wanted to do like the Burgundies are doing this. I learned it. My father said, no, this is impossible. How you get the whole dirt out of this small barrel? And no, I want to do it.
What was it about Burgundy that was interesting to you?
The fact that it's the structure of the companies, of the wineries, were quite the same. It's the whole surrounding, it was a farming surrounding. It was not this kind of nobility surrounding like in Bordeaux. Even though most of the growers in Burgundy were very much, or in Austria, very much influenced by the idea of a Bordeaux wine, especially in the red wine productions, Bordeaux was the idea. Bordeaux was the topic. Everybody moved or tried to at least visit Bordeaux in the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, to see how they work. And this was immediately the idea of how the wine should be like. But this was something which was obviously, it's kind of lying maybe somewhere in the genetic structure of Burgenland wine grower, that they're always seeking their luck in the neighbor's garden and not checking what's the point within ourselves, what's the heritage. This was, in a matter of fact, the thing what I was very much driven by, to have a look what is ours and how can we achieve something which is original, authentic, uncomparable, just honest.
Today's episode is brought to you by Melio, a digital payables platform made just for small businesses. If you're a small business and you deal with a bunch of different vendors, as I know I do at my restaurants, sometimes it can be hard to keep track of a ton of different invoices, all with different pay-by dates and different terms. Melio is one simple platform that allows you to centralize all of your invoices and pay them on a timely manner, making sure that you're never late for a payment, or sometimes even worse, pay too early. With Melio, sending payments and even requesting them is made simple and easy and can be done all in one local place. Visit gomelio.com and add your first bill to get started. What is the heritage of Blaufränkisch and the area?
Well, you know, I started a project which is called Hidden Treasures recently, where I try to figure that, doing a kind of research through the bottle, like looking for the message in the bottle, trying to find the message in the bottle. I'm very convinced, I mean, this is obvious, but it has been lost for a while, that our heritage is within this Carpathian Basin, Pannonian Plains. So you have to imagine Burgenland is the so-called youngest federal state of Austria. It became part of Austria in 1921. Before that, it was called Deutsch-Westungarn, German Western Hungary. So it was the Western German-speaking area of Hungary, and a little part of it became Burgenland later on. So a lot of people consider Burgenland as a young wine-growing area. In fact, it's a young political structure, but it's a very, very old wine-growing area within this Hungarian wine world, which was, in the 19th century, Hungary was wine-wise worldwide a superpower. By far, the most expensive, most sought-after wines in that area, like beginning in middle of 19th century, came from Hungary. So we found old wine lists from German distributors in Berlin and in Munich. You can see the prices, and there was a Romane Conti or Chateau Latour was sold for one gold mark. A Sahuelli or Mosel Auslese were two gold marks. And the sweet wines from around the Lake Neusiedl and Tokaj were four gold marks. If you adapt it nowadays, that would be kind of a price.
Four times the price of Romane Conti.
Yeah, well, that's cool, no?
Yeah.
Would be. But it's not cool because we love to show our wines to a wider audience.
Were the dry wines from that area also
sure
well regarded?
So there was a great demand for sweet wine, of course, because there was not much sweet stuff yeah around. But there were several places. One of those were, for example, Somló, which is nowadays in Hungary, about 1 hour south of my place. This was the most famous place for dry whites, for example, in this whole area. But we need as well that there is an old classification in Sopron. The German word, the German name for Sopron is Ödenburg, which was the capital of Deutsch-Westungarn, Wahr place, which is now also Hungary. They had a classification based on tax payments from the 16th century. And the most widely planted varieties were Furmint for the whites and Blaufränkisch for the reds. And for sure, this was dry wine. Furmint and as well, especially Blaufränkisch, were dry. And Ödenburger Blaufränkisch, so Sopron Kekfrankusch, as it would be the Hungarian name, this was a very much sought-after wine in those days.
And for your Hidden Treasures project, are you trying to make wine in maybe in the style that they were made in those days? Or how are you trying to find that heritage?
Well, we try to, in a way. We try to understand, maybe it's less trying to source out the style which has been used in these days. It's rather more on the quest for the specific character of the places we are working in or on, because I'm very confident that it's more about the character of the place than about the style. If you like, we have two major developments nowadays in the wine world. I mean, much more probably, but let's keep it on these two. So the one is where the style follows the place. The place is the important thing. And the other one is where the other way around, where the place has to follow the style. So it doesn't matter what kind of terroir, what kind of climatic situation you find. It's more about the style you have to follow. It doesn't matter if this is now an industrialized style or a hip style.
So, it's a great way to put it. And I think about this a lot, is that in so many of the hip natural wines, they say they're making distinctive wines, but oftentimes they taste very similar, maybe in the same way that an industrial wine will all taste similar. But your wines are all so distinctive.
Well, I've got a feeling sometimes it's like that, you know. Yeah. At the end, it's... I was very much in the beginning connected with this natural wine movement. We do a lot of work in Copenhagen with the Noma when they started off. And it was a fun time, but sometimes I got the feeling things became up and then a bit too much self-referential, too much facade-like, too much style. And, you know, talking about heritage, one has to be clear about where do I come from, to get a clue where we can go towards, especially in a surrounding where, because of political surrounding, because of political development, and that's the point in our region, it's a tremendous point that this was cut through with the barbed wire. You know, we had watchtowers where people with machine guns were standing up there, and there were villages has been divided by politics. And if politics doesn't work properly, culture collapses. And at the end of the day, it's in our business, I think it's so much about culture. If you make cultural heritage, I think the nature of wine is culture and not the other way around. There would be no wine without the idea of culture, you know, because this is an achievement. And just talking about natural components within this wine business is neglecting totally the work, the hard work, the very hard work of generations of farmers, which has designed and defined those cultural wine growing surrounding all over the world. It doesn't matter if it's in Burgenland, if it's in the Priorat, or it's in Piemonte, wherever, you know, or in Mosel Valley. This is serious. This was seriously hard work. And this is based on cultural achievements.
The Hidden Treasures Project is in Hungary, right? Is
that... No, it's all around. So the concept is, in a matter of fact, the Hidden Treasures Project is a continuation of the Moritz Project, because Moritz has become finally a proper winery. So we produce 90% by ourselves, and we're still buying some grapes in to continue the research. But in a matter of fact, it was a quest. And so Moritz became a winery, so the quest has to go on. And invented Hidden Treasures. It's the same idea to source out gaining experience about a certain region, which has something in common. And the thing they have in common is this Carpathian Basin. So this was all covered by the Pannonian Sea. So the majority of the wines are grown on the sediments of the sea or on the volcanic spots within or on this primary rock surroundings, which is left. Like in Burgenland, so literally we plant our wines on the last hills of the Eastern Alps. And all those vineyards has in common that they're facing towards the plains. So it's not, in all this Pannonian surrounding, you always face towards the plains. When there is fog, you have the feeling you dive into the sea.
I'd love to go back to the earlier stages of Moritz Winery, back into the 80s when you were planting Chardonnay and sort of just getting started. Mm-hmm. What were those early days like? You said now Moritz is sort of a real winery, maybe. And what's the difference between now that's sort of a real winery and before you considered it sort of a real winery?
Well, the Chardonnay and the sweet wine period was within my family's wineries, which is now my brother's running, which is the Velich Winery. And so it was great to work with the family, but there was one day there was the point where I said, maybe it's better to work without the family. And so I started the Moritz thing. And it's just the idea to have a look because, you know, I'm a critical person and the idea of thinking, reflecting on certain topics or issues means that there must be some doubt. Doubting something means not that I'm don't like or whatever. Doubting means I think about. So I was thinking about how would that be and this be if I'm doing things in this or in that way. So I wanted to know how this grape variety behaves when I'm changing some things in vinification and selection process. So as I was a fan of traditional Piemontese wines, but also the old styled or Burgundy wines with the idea of finesse and clarity and sense of place. And I wanted to see how this variety will behave if I'm working with old wines, with low yields, no overripeness, no new oak, no heavy toasting, no super extracting, and see behind if this, when I'm doing that, how will this variety behave, and will this variety be able to transmit specific characters of place and soil? Is this variety capable to transmit terroir
sense? And you weren't able to do that at the family winery.
Well, the family winery is, you know, the place where it's located, it's in the Sevenkiel area. This is not a red wine area. So Blaufränkisch was not important in this region. So the place where Blaufränkisch was very important were the nowadays places in Burgenland, they were surrounding Ödenburg, you know, the former capital town, because Ödenburg, Blaufränkisch was the big brand. So all around in the middle Burgenland, in the northern Burgenland area, which surrounding this area, these were the places where a lot of Blaufränkisch has been planted over the time. So I went there and I went to Lutzmannsburg, which is a tiny little place. There's a village, there's a river, and then you have to go up the hill, and there's a plateau on the hill, which it's a primordial volcanic hill. And on top of that, 200 hectares of wine, 85% Blaufränkisch, and this is probably the place where the oldest Blaufränkisch wines on the planet are still alive. To be honest, I have no idea if this is true. I never proved it, but I just say it. So, and I was lucky enough to convince some growers there to sell me some grapes. And we had 80, 90, 100-year-old wines. This was really a treasure. And the next year, so this was 2001, in 2002, we started then in a neighboring village in Neckenmarkt, very different terroir on schist and gneiss and a bit of limestone, steeper soil, up to 400 meters of elevation, to prove where is the difference? See, and I have to say the difference was tremendous. And I was so happy, you know, I have these two places and the wines were super and expressive and this. And then I figured that the people in Austria, some liked it, but a lot didn't like because this was so different to the style they are used to.
What was the standard style?
Yeah, well, this was this idea of, you know, with one eye in the neighbor's cherry garden. This was Cabernet, Merlot, this was the new achievement, a lot of new oak, a lot of toasting, heavy extracted, tannic. You know, in those days it was very popular to use 200% new oak, as if 100% wouldn't be anyway far too much. And this is something where it destroyed completely the sense and the idea of a certain cultural heritage, culture at all. So sweet and rich and aromatic, fruity red wines.
And with 100 or 200% new oak, you couldn't tell the difference if it was planted in the plains or in the hills.
No way.
It tastes the same.
No way. But even more than that, I've got sometimes the feeling, and I was really blamed for that, because I said, I consider our wines much more, because I was asked, I can remember when I was, I don't know, in 2006 or so in New York, I was asked, we did this tasting with a group of journalists in the Gramercy Tavern, which was a very important tasting with a couple of growers. I was asked, what would you compare Blaufränkisch with? And I said, of course, yeah, it's somewhere in this triangle, Pinot Noir, Burgundy, Piemontese, Nebbiolo, and Northern Rhone, Syrah. And this is a comparison which has been used and very often by a lot of people. I just said it because I like these regions. And of course, when you like things and you're into, you compare it with that. And there is something. Depends on which soils Blaufränkisch is grown. You have a little bit, primary rock is maybe a bit more, you know, this herbaceousness and this fruitiness of a Syrah. If it's on limestone, you have maybe a bit more of this, and if it's like that. So. And I was blamed when I was back home. They said, we don't want to do Blaufränkisch which tastes like Piemont or Burgundy. We want to produce Blaufränkisch which is like Burgenland Blaufränkisch. Yeah, but you never did. You were always looking to something, you know.
So you got pushback from the other growers.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. In a way. But my commitment was from the very beginning, was very clear, and it's still on my website, which is still in the same shape as it ever was, unfortunately. But the only thing I had in mind from the very beginning on is producing an authentic Blaufränkisch, which tastes like Burgenland and Blaufränkisch. That's it.
How did you know that Blaufränkisch could be so terroir-specific, especially considering it wasn't the norm at the time?
Well, first of all, it was kind of widely planted. Secondly, it was a variety where I thought, I mean, there were some very, not very much, but some examples where you can see that there is a great ageability potential within this variety. There is a great acidity. There is a very interesting tannin situation, but this was in the same way the problem, because when you have too high yields and harvest maybe too early or too late or whatever, you have a greenish tannin structure with a lot of acidity, and then you add a lot of new oak with that, and then you have to, you know, this kind of could be kind of edgy then. And Blaufränkisch tends then to be rustique, because Blaufränkisch is a noble variety. You have to treat a noble variety as a noble variety. You know, you can't work with that varieties with, I don't know, 10, 15 tons a hectare. It's not interesting. This is not easy. You have to bring them in the right way. You have to get them mature. And not talking about sugar levels, talking much more about quality of the phenolics, of the tannins, and balance, and time.
And in order to treat like a noble variety, you have to have lower yields, or at least balance with the yields, full ripeness. And what else do you do in order to treat Blaufränkisch as a noble variety?
We take a lot of care. So it needs a lot of green work in the vineyard during summer. So you need to do a proper work with the leaf. The whole canopy management is very important. And I believe in the idea of having, you know, there was a time when we believed in three walls, of a canopy wall, 3 meter high. And the balance, again, I think it's always give and take. If there is too much growth, it's not good. If there is not enough growth, it's not good. I figured out, especially working with these old wines, quite often you have not just a little bit of leaf, but you have tiny quantities, but it's sufficient for some grapes which are on this wine.
And all this work is done by hand, I imagine.
Right? It's 100% done by hand, yeah. The only thing we're doing partly with the machine is opening or plowing the soil between the wines. That's it, up and then. But this is all depends on the situation of the vintage, but that's it. The rest is done by hand. Spraying is also done by machines.
But your sprays are all organic. You're talking copper and sulfur.
Yeah, we're doing copper and sulfur and some coconut and lime oil, and that's it, in the matter of fact.
This episode of In the Drink is sponsored by Vias. For over 36 years, Vias has been a leading importer and distributor of some of Italy's finest wines. Their philosophy is quality, history, and transparency, and they think that wine should always have a story to tell and should always represent its terroir to the fullest. You know, I've been working with VIAS at my restaurants for over 10 years, but I just found out what the acronym VIAS actually stands for, and I think it's pretty cool. It means Vitigni Italiani Autoctoni Selezionati, or Selected Italian Indigenous Grapes. So that means that the wines in their portfolio are wines made from native Italian grapes, and they're wines that clearly exhibit their terroir, local culture, and deep history. VIAS has over 76 unique brands imported to the U.S., including some of my favorites like the Produttori del Barbaresco, Berici, Salvioni, Castello di Rampola, and many others. So keep an eye out for that VIAS label on the back of a bottle of wine because it's the mark that something uniquely delicious is inside. This episode of In the Drink is brought to you by 750.com. 750.com is the most important resource for beverage buyers. I use 750.com on a daily basis, not just because of the vast amount of products that are listed on the site. I mean, everything I could possibly want for my restaurants, Fausto and Lalu, are located on 750, but also because of how reliable that information is. For me, when I'm ordering something, I need to know that it's going to be there and the information on it is going to be accurate and true so that I can plan out my beverage program. So it's always so helpful to me to know that when I order something on 750, it's going to be the wine or the beer or the liquor that they say it's going to be there. It's the correct vintage. It's in stock. They know that it matters and makes a huge difference for buyers just like me and like you. So go to 750.com and open up an account today. I've read before that you're, although your practices are organic, you're not into the idea of being certified. Is that accurate?
Well, that's an interesting story. So we're working in that way quite a while now because I'm convinced to do it because it's, you know, this is one of the ideas of quality and treating it as a noble variety. But in the same way, I figured that a lot of people keep asking, how do you work here? When you say, well, we do it in that way. So this is it organic? Said, no, it's not organic because the word organic is protected. You can't use it if you're not certified, either organic or biodynamic. So I've chosen to say, we do it in that way. But a lot of people keep telling nowadays that they're working organically and they're not doing it. We are anyway like that, but we are not certified. And we buy, most of the food I'm buying is organic because it just proves for myself that this is produced in a certain way. So I was convinced by my children then that we should do this certification. And I hate kind of certifications, you know. I don't need somebody who is certifying my work because the work is anyway highly driven by a certain quality. I have myself, which is anyway a burden in any direction. But I was convinced that we started now a certification process for organic wine growing.
Are your kids very involved in the winery?
Partly, yes. A little bit. One of the boys is in the company. The other one was, it's in and out, and Stella, our daughter, she's 18. She's getting a bit more interested. She's more interested in the Instagram stuff nowadays than the wine growing, but maybe one day.
What percentage of your grapes do you purchase versus grow yourself?
Well, you know, when we started the project, it was 100% purchase. Nowadays, I would say it's more than 90% is produced by ourselves, and we're still buying about 10% with in order to check out.
And the percentage that you produce yourself, do you own those vineyards or do you lease the vineyards?
So most of the vineyards we are owning meantime. We have some vineyards which are leased, but the majority is owned now.
Is it hard to buy good quality? I know you work with a lot of old vine vineyards in the Burgenland.
I should say now, yes, it's very hard because it's such a precious country and it is a precious piece of land. But it's unfortunately still very easy to buy, especially right now, because obviously there's a shift of generation and it's not very expensive. And yeah, it's good. One can buy. It depends on which places and where, but it's possible. It's not that difficult.
What was the first vineyard that you purchased and what was that like? It must have felt pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the first vineyard? Well, the first vineyard I bought was in Lutzmersburg. And it was a vineyard which was sold by Mr. Fazikas. Mr. Fazikas is a Hungarian name. And this is a vineyard where he told me, this is a vineyard, his parents has planted in the beginning of the 20th century, so 1922. So this was when Burgenland just became Austrian. And most of the wines were lying on the ground, and so we have to spend a lot of work in this vineyard. I like this vineyard a lot. Still brings very, very good quality.
And it seems that you have a very clear idea as to the types of wines you want to make now. Has that changed since the early days?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think this is a process of development, a development of oneself. And I mean, you shape your palates by doing something. You shape your mind by working with your mind. You shape your intellectually by stressing your intellectual approach. And I consider wine as something which has a lot to do with aesthetics in the wider meaning of the word. And you have to shape your senses in order to achieve and enjoy aesthetic fully. And wine is something what you only can enjoy through your senses. And in the way you shape and develop your senses, you develop your approach. And I would suggest if you meet a wine grower who tells you he knows exactly now, this is the way and no other way, you should doubt it. Because I think there are thousands of ways. This is the fantastic and the fascinating thing about wine growing. There are thousands of ways to create a great wine.
And has your style of winemaking changed over the years as well?
I wouldn't say the style has changed, because the style, the idea of, again, it's more about trying to unveil the character of the place, transmitted, translated by the variety. But of course, the approach has changed a bit. So we learned more and more about the places and the variety itself. And I think the longer I'm working with this variety, the more we tend to go towards greater finesse, greater elegance, less extraction, you know, more and more perfection in selecting and vineyard work, of course. But in the matter of fact, it was the idea from the very beginning, trying to do something which has the greatest possible concentration, aromatical concentration, with the greatest possible finesse and elegance. This is very, very hard to achieve. This is a very thin line. And this is the idea, that's the goal towards what we try to optimize in a way. And the more you know, the more I've got the feeling we come closer, but then comes a year which is then again different. And it's a process.
Now that much of the wine world likes wines more of finesse and elegance, like the world has changed a lot in the way what people drink in the last 20 years. Do you feel vindicated? Do you feel justified in your approach from the beginning? Have other producers sort of laid off the yoke and started to make wines in your style as well?
I wouldn't say I feel justified. No, I wouldn't say that. Because I knew from the very beginning on I was right. So no, especially because, you know, you have a certain source. You have a region, you have a climate. And you have something I always considered our region as a cool climate red wine area. And I always explained this is a big, big, big advantage, because there are not much regions which can do that, especially then with a known variety, which has that big, great ability to transmit it as well. So I'll keep talking about that. But I was very clear that this is the way it should be done, because everything gives it. So at the end, I'm very happy, I have to say, that there are a couple of young growers in our region which moving in the same direction very strictly. It's not easy still, because even though, as you mentioned, the international development moves quite intensely in that direction, in Austria, the market is a little bit different. So there's still a lot of this heavy, dark, oaky red wine. There's quite a demand, and the wines with finesse and filigrane and good acidity and balance, still not easy. So, but it's getting better.
I remember the first time tasting your wine. I used to have a wine bar called Amphora in the West Village, and being, it's somehow elated and sad at the same time, because it was such a beautiful and elegant wine, and I had never tasted an Austrian red wine that had that. And I knew that if someone could do it, then others could as well.
Sure.
There has to be other potential.
Sure.
And to me, it's still a benchmark. Your wines are so beautiful. We're so honored to pour them at Lalu. And so you work not only with Blaufränkisch, but with some other grapes as well, predominantly Blaufränkisch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, still.
But a little bit of Grüner Veltliner,
yes.
A little bit of the Ferment and Harschlevelu.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the other wines?
Well, the Ferment and the Harschlevelu varieties are more within this Hidden Treasures project, which is great. And it's the same story with like Blaufränkisch. This is ours, you know. This is because you asked before as well, why Blaufränkisch? Because it's here, you know. If you ask a mountain climber, why is climbing up the mountain? Is it because the mountain is here? It's the same reason. It's ours, so we have to do it. And these varieties has proved over centuries that they are good for this area. And the Grüner Veltliner was something different because Grüner Veltliner came to Burgenland. There was not much Grüner Veltliner in this Hungarian part of the monarchy, but it came to Burgenland after Burgenland became Austrian in 1921. And because we were quite quickly, we became a cheap producer for Grüner Veltliner for our colleagues and friends from Lower Austria, from the Wachau Valley. So this is the reason why Grüner Veltliner became quickly the most widely planted white variety in Burgenland. And it happens to be that there's still quite a bit left, and especially on this in the north at the Leitergebirge, we have this very pure and rocky limestone soils. And I thought it might be interesting because I like white wines on limestone. I like this kind of focus and density and minerality, saltiness. So I did some experiment in a traditional way, a little bit more oxidized. This was 2006. Then we kept going, and it's very, very interesting to work with this variety, but people still complaining about this wine, that this wine doesn't taste like Grüner Veltliner. And my answer is still, if my Grüner Veltliner from this place would taste the same like a Grüner Veltliner from the Wachau Valley, from my point of view, it would be a mistake because it's very different. The soil, the climate, everything. So it has to be different. And then what happened over the years now, that the regulations within the quality wine approval authority state done thing is got stricter and stricter. Well, not really stricter. In the matter of fact, one has to say they got more superficial, because every lousy industrialized, 100%, 1,000% industrialized wine gets this approval for quality wine. And you have to have this approval to write the name of the origin, the name of the vineyard, the name of the town where it's grown, or Burgenland on the label. If you don't get this approval for quality wine, you are not allowed to write this on. And over the last years, we didn't get this approval. And when this problem started, so I inquired several times, and at the end we got it. But then from a certain point on, I decided I give them just one more chance. Just one chance. If they fail, I don't inquire anymore for quality wine. And this whole thing started when we started to blacken the label, because I consider this way, because they disqualified the wines. And they disqualified the wines with the arguments these wines are untypical for the place and untypical for the variety and faulty and oxidized and reductive and all this bullshit. So then I decided to blacken it, because I wanted to show on the label, this is discrimination. This is something which is censoring. And that was kind of funny. A lot of people said, well, you are super, and this is a super marketing gag. And it's not a marketing thing. This is a really note of protest against ignorance and incompetency and idiotic behavior at the end of the day. And then after some years, I did something else, because everybody's a good marketer. So I started to do this. So 2016, St. Georg Grüner Veltliner is now called Serious Wine from a Gorgeous Place. And the subtitle shows, translated into English, the arguments of the authorities why they disqualified the wine. So all that, it's not typical for place or variety. It's all on the label now. And 2018, we've done then another Serious Wine from the same Gorgeous Place, and again. So I'm still, you know, trying to focus, show the protest against that.
And so the idea that most Gruner Veltliner that they're tasting is fermented and aged just in stainless steel, has lots of fruit, and you're doing something maybe, is it fair to say, industrial yeast, which can give aromatics. Is it fair to say you're treating it more like someone would treat like a very high quality white Burgundy?
Yes.
That idea. And you're trying to showcase the place and not just the fruit.
Right. This is exactly the point. And the problem behind is that more and more wines getting a problem with that. Wines which are produced in that way as trying to be authentic, original, getting problems to achieve this approval. So they cannot name the origin on the label. But all the other wines, which are very industrialized produced, are getting this approval. So that means that there is a shift towards something which is a style, which is very exchangeable. And there's more and more, so they take us away our origin. They are stealing our origin. And this is something which cannot be, because it's such an old wine growing area. It's such a fantastic place, a gorgeous place, you know. We have to do something against it.
And it seems like those other wines are the ones that aren't indicative of where they come from. They're not... Maybe they're typical of industrial winemaking, but they're not typical of Burgenland, right?
For sure not. For sure not. And because of this whole historical development, because of, you know, that this was divided, and then it was Austria, and now and there was a loss of everything in a way. There was a loss of culture. And to bring it all back, it's not easy. You know, it takes a lot of time. And when the things shifts or moves towards something which is so diluted by industrial standards, and then they call it DAC, and they got the origin. You know, this doesn't help the region. It doesn't develops the region. It's nothing. It's okay when you're sitting somewhere in the middle of the desert without blaming the desert. Maybe they can do also good wine, but this is precious, extremely old wine growing heritage. So we have to fight for that.
Do you know the Cascina Ebreo wines from Piedmont?
Yeah.
You've heard of? He has a similar story where they made organic wine unfiltered and got denied and eventually just said, I'm not going to make it. And he writes Torpedo on the label instead of Barolo.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's cool. I think it's cool too.
It's good.
I love serious wine from Gorgeous Place. And then the Ferment and Harsh Levelu.
Yeah.
How did that project come to be? How did those wines come to be?
Well, because of the same reason. It's to source out what we are, how we are. Because to transport as well our history, our historical record. I mean, to show people in the audience.
The connection between Austria and Hungary.
The connection between Burgenland, especially, and Hungary. And in order to transmit this old idea of a wine growing area, that this is something which has to be transmitted as one region, in a way, as one cultural region, and of course, Fuhrmann is the white counterpart of Blaufränkisch. You know, I mean, we are. I think I'm 100% sure that we're living in a world where there's so much influences. I mean, we have. Meanwhile, it's a profession influence, you know, as far as I hear from my daughter. We have to create narratives, not invent them, you know, because a good narrative is obviously existing. We just have to transmit it. We have to tell the customer the story in a way that they can understand and develop a frame, a picture of it. And if you like, Hidden Treasures is this frame, is this narrative we try to tell beyond national borders. It's a narrative about cultural heritage, in a matter of fact. And there are some very important varieties which were always in Blaufränkisch, Furmint, Harsh Levelu, Welsh Riesling, or the Hungarians say Olas Riesling, or the Slavics say Lasky Riesling. It's all the same source, same meaning. And I think these varieties were always there, and these varieties are capable to transmit this wine-wise, this narrative.
Are there some unique challenges that are posed by working in two countries, even though they're so close physically?
Oh, well, yeah, it's not so easy. There is law-wise in Hungary, as not Hungarian, it's not easy. But actually, the whole thing started as well because I wanted to buy a winery in Chomlo. Chomlo is a magnificent place. It's this this, I mean, the Nordstromlo, the big Stromlo mountain, because this, these are four mountains. This is an island within the plains, and this is fantastic. But legally, I couldn't buy it because as a not Hungarian, I couldn't buy it. So and in those days, I developed the idea of hidden treasures in order to have a tool where I can produce. And the idea is to do a co-production with growers in Stromlo, in Balaton, in Tokaj. So the wines are done in the cellar of our partners there. The idea of the wine is very much into, you know, driven by myself, but it's a co-production.
Are there other projects that you're working on now that are not yet released?
Well, I have a lot of ideas. I mean, one project is Jagini. This is a Blaufränkisch. This was the first project beside Moritz. I'm doing that with Hannes Schuster, my friend and partner, and he's one of the fantastic, great young producers in Burgenland. And this is a place. Blaufränkisch comes from a place which is called Zagersdorf, and this is a very special place. Just 20 hectares of wines left, unfortunately, but it is heavy clay with a high content of chalk in there. And the wines need so much time that we decided to keep it long in barrel, and because we don't have to make our living out of that, and it's not a big production, we decided then to keep these wines long in barrel. So now we just released 2013, so we kept the wine 5.5 years in barrel, and this is fantastic. This is great. And besides that, I have some weird ideas like, the liberation of the Pinot Gris, because I think Pinot Gris is not a white variety. This is a true rosé variety, you know, and to respect this variety, you have to ferment them on the skins, you know. And if you ferment varieties like Pinot Gris on the skins, this is all of a sudden, it becomes a very interesting variety because it is more of this Pinot Noir style. It's a white wine.
For sure, when you ferment on the skins, you see the relation between Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris.
And Pinot Gris, yeah. Absolutely. All of a sudden, no?
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. In the Drink is produced by Jesmond Mali of Seaplane Armada. Special thanks to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. I also want to give a huge thanks to our sponsors, Via 750 and Melio. Please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. If you have any questions or have any suggestions for guests, please feel free to shoot an email over to me at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.